Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Today's guest, Mother Jones reporter Rebecca Lieber, is out with a new investigation called How the Fossil Fuel Industry Convinced Americans to Love Gas Stoves. She reports that as more municipalities have moved to phase gas lines out of new buildings to cut down on methane emissions, gas utilities have gone on the defensive. And they're launching anti-electric campaigns across the country. The fossil fuel industry has spent millions to convince people to use gas in their homes. They're also trying to stop the transition from gas to electric by lobbying local and state governments to push them to stop the electrification of home appliances. So why does this matter? Well, Rebecca Lieber reports that gas connections in homes are at an all-time high. The share of gas stoves in newly constructed single-family homes climbed from below 30% in the 1970s to about 50% today. Natural gas is a powerful contributor to climate change and can cause serious health problems. Climate emissions from gas and oil-powered buildings make up 12% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, and gas stoves emit a host of dangerous pollutants, including particulate matter, formaldehyde, carbon monoxide, and nitrogen dioxide. And we'll talk more about health effects in today's show. Joining us to talk about her investigation is Rebecca Lieber, a reporter in Mother Jones, D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back to the show.
It's so great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you. Rebecca, you've been really following this issue for a while now. Last June, you published a piece that exposed how gas groups representing utilities hired social media influencers to convince millennials and Gen Xers that gas stoves are the superior way to cook. And you reported at that time that the two main campaigns are the work of gas trade groups, the American Public Gas Association and the American Gas Association, which is comprised of privately owned utilities. I've noticed that in the last 6 or so months, this issue is starting to get more media attention. Do you agree with that?
It certainly has. I think this is a really big issue for the climate movement going into 2021 and beyond. Last year, there were a series of reports released by Sierra Club, UCLA, and Rocky Mountain Institute linking gas stoves to health effects. And I think that combined with cities moving towards cleaner building sectors, that has created this perfect storm for becoming the next frontier for climate battles.
So let's just talk about some basic facts that you lay out in your piece. You report that gas connections in U.S. homes are at an all-time high. As I mentioned in the intro, the share of gas stoves in newly constructed single-family homes climbed from below 30% back in the 70s to about 50% today.
Yeah, so gas has the gas portion of the electric sector and for our buildings has increased and decreased over the last century. This is a long battle between electrified appliances and gas-powered appliances. So what we've seen the last few decades, partly pushed by lower gas prices, is this adoption for gas-powered buildings. Now, we see this really unevenly distributed across the country. So not the entire country isn't reliant on gas, but we really see, especially in some major cities, that gas is the predominant source for power for buildings. And that's especially true for cities in California.
So in California, New York, you report Illinois, well over 70% of the population relies on gas for cooking.
Right. And That is in existing buildings, of course, but the future of the gas sector is dependent on continuing to put gas lines for newly constructed buildings. So it's important to remember when we're talking about these electrification efforts, we're still talking about new construction, not existing construction. I think where we see the gas industry really trying to drive a wedge issue here is telling people they will lose their stoves in their buildings. And that's not true. That's, we're talking about new hookups.
You also report that climate emissions from gas and oil-powered buildings make up a full 12% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And just a couple of decades ago, electricity was not the obviously cleaner choice. Now it's the main strategy for cleaning stubborn sources of pollution. So can you talk more about the research that's been done looking at climate emissions from gas and oil-powered buildings?
Right. I think this also ties back to your original question. Why are we talking about this now? So for a long time, coal has been the focus for environmentalists because coal, until the last decade, was the primary source of power in the electricity sector. So for decades, electricity wasn't the obviously cleaner choice because coal also has a range of health problems and is a huge contributor to climate change. What's changed is coal is declining in the power sector, and the power sector is becoming cleaner. And that trend is only supposed to continue in coming decades. So with the power sector getting cleaner, environmentalists have turned attention to natural gas. And this is a fossil fuel that hasn't received the same level of scrutiny as coal, even though study after study shows we are undercounting the amount of emissions from the oil and gas sector because of methane. And that we also are only now the public is understanding the full effect of methane emissions on public health. So gas is only now receiving that level of scrutiny. And that it is a powerful contributor to climate change. I think we've had other areas of intense carbon emissions to focus on. But with the power sector getting cleaner, the attention has turned to gas.
Why do you think gas hasn't received as much scrutiny?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, one that I just laid out. But one big piece of this investigation was looking at the marketing. The gas industry has had a century to cultivate public opinion and shape our views on gas. I think, just think about the name, natural gas. There's a lot of reasons we call it natural gas, but the industry has certainly capitalized on the connotation that natural seems healthier to people, even though that's not true. So it's in the actual name, the marketing, that gas is cleaner than other sources of energy. There's so many other ways that the industry markets gas as this cleaner fossil fuel, even though the science doesn't support that. And that was a big subject of my piece, looking at the marketing and PR industry that has really propped up this myth that gas is clean.
It was interesting to read about the history in your piece. As you just said, the industry embraced the term natural gas, which gives the impression that its product is cleaner than any other fossil fuel. You point to a 1934 ad, again, 1934, and this ad bragged, quote, "The discovery of natural gas brought to man the greater and most efficient heating fuel which the world has ever known. Justly, it is called nature's perfect fuel."
This was one of my favorite parts of reporting this story, looking at old newspaper ads from the last century and other forms of marketing from the industry, because it's fascinating how much we still hear in talking points from the industry, but also just repeated as this common knowledge that was originally a marketing campaign. The very phrase "cooking with gas" that your listeners might have even used in their daily life, that was an invention of gas marketers in the 1930s. So it's really fascinating to trace that campaign throughout history. I think Things that I hear all the time, including in pushback to my story, was how people just prefer their gas stoves, or it heats up their food faster, or it's just the superior method for cooking. These can also be traced to ads that the industry has run for the better part of a century, including this 1934 ad that you pointed out.
Right. And there's such a through line. But back then, they were trying to convince housewives to get their husband to, quote, you know, renovate their kitchens. And then when you take it to today, what you have uncovered, and this was really interesting to learn, is that these social media influencers, women are posting these gorgeous kitchens on Instagram and talking about how much they love their gas stoves.
Right. That's where we see the gas stove as this wedge issue for the industry. I think it's become this kind of status symbol, and that's where this paid social media influencer campaign that I've written about, where that comes in, that the industry loves the idea that the stove could be a status symbol, that it is something that is aspirational. And that's where the marketing and targeting, particularly of women, comes in. We see that with this social media campaign that I wrote about back in June, where American Gas Association and American Public Gas Association, they have hired PR firms to run these influencer campaigns. They're really wild kind of Instagram posts and YouTube clips that were in my original story in June, showing influencers saying how great the stove is at frying up a tortilla, and always being careful to emphasize natural in natural gas. Now, what was fascinating in the seeds of this investigation, where that came in, was when I obtained emails from the industry reacting to that original reporting and discussing this influencer campaign, of how much it meant to them, how much it means to the future of the stove to continue this kind of marketing, and how they couldn't afford to stop it, even in light of the negative press that my original reporting generated.
And then another campaign that you uncovered is as people posing as neighbors on Nextdoor to promote gas stoves, even though they don't live in the community. So you report that in early 2020, Wilson Truong posted on the Nextdoor social media platform, where users can send messages to a group of people in their neighborhood. In a Culver City, California community, he wrote as if he were a resident of a Fox Hills neighborhood, warning the group that their city leaders were considering stronger building codes that would discourage natural gas lines in newly built homes and businesses. And he said, "Culver City banning stoves? First time I heard about it, I thought it was bogus, but I received a newsletter from the city about public hearings to discuss it. Will it pass?" And then, as you write, that really ignited a heated debate.
Yeah, so I think this was the PR industry's, the PR group that Wilson Truong worked for. They were experimenting with other kinds of social media strategies beyond the influencers, like having people post on Nextdoor to oppose ordinances like Culver City was considering. So, like you said, he posed as a concerned community member and generated some response from other members of the community who said, "Don't take away my gas stove." This incident was an extension of the group Californians for Balanced Energy Solutions. Now, that is a group that has been working with SoCalGas, the nation's largest gas utility, to fight electrification efforts very aggressively in California. They've tried a number of tactics. One was threatening to bus in protesters at the start of the pandemic, violating social distancing guidelines. And this Nextdoor post was another example of this incredibly aggressive campaign to fight communities that are pushing for electrification. Now, when I went to Truong's employer, they insisted this was an isolated incident on Nextdoor, that they are no longer even working with this client. But that doesn't mean that this kind of campaign has stopped. There are the group Californians for Balanced Energy Solutions continues to campaign aggressively against cities that are even considering phasing out gas in new buildings. And just because this one PR group has phased out this campaign, it doesn't mean these kinds of tactics will stop.
Today, we are joined by Mother Jones reporter Rebecca Lieber talking about her latest investigation, how the fossil fuel industry convinced Americans to love gas stoves. The piece she wrote in December is called "These Ladies Love Natural Gas. Too bad they aren't real." An oil industry group went to bizarre lengths to court women. And you can find these pieces at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Rebecca about her reporting about the gas industry, and also any questions about cities really passing rules and laws to transition over to electric appliances, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Joyce who says, "I appreciate the concerns about using gas in homes. I am of a generation that believes gas stoves are essential for good cooking, for their responsiveness to turn on or off heat quickly. This belief is certainly based on how difficult it has been to cook on old electric stoves. Please ask Rebecca to address new electric stove technology if, in fact, that has overcome past shortcomings."
Yeah, it's a great question. So there is something that called the induction stove, and this is an electrified stove, but it is a more modern successor to, I think, the electric stoves that people really hate. I think when we're talking about electric stoves, people generally think about technologies that are very outdated. We're talking about what was popular in the 60s and 70s, these electric coils that do heat very inefficiently. The more modern replacement, the induction stove, I have not personally cooked on, but I have heard raving reviews from people that it is fast, that it works with all kinds of pans. And this is something that's only just starting to spread in the U.S. This is much more common technology in other countries than the U.S. So I think if we start seeing cities adopt these ordinances to clean up the building sector, we would see the induction stove really spread more in this country.
And then we have a second question from Joyce who says, "When electricity is not available during a brownout or storm outage, one can still cook on a gas cooktop until electricity is restored. What about that flexibility?"
Yeah, this has certainly come up with the Texas blackouts the last few weeks. I think there's a few things to note. This is and important to remember when we're talking about fossil fuel infrastructure, because this debate about what is the most reliable energy source is a really common one and extends beyond cooking. Now, generally, to have a resilient infrastructure, it's less about the source than the actual broader system. So, for example, Texas, the problem with blackouts partly stemmed from it having a relatively small power grid that is in state, that it didn't have other parts of the country to draw power from. And that can be fixed or at least partly addressed by improving transmission lines and in better oversight from Texas regulators and federal regulators. The other point I think people should keep in mind is gas lines to buildings and gas itself. I think we are so used to this status quo, for example, like carbon monoxide poisoning, that this is something we just accept as a risk of gas. But I think we should remember there are risks to using fossil fuels in one's home, and we can get into the health effects in just a bit. But the gas lines can blow up and explode, and they do still with some regularity. We just, I think, as a society, tend to look the other way because we're now used to it. Mm-hmm. And gas in homes can also cause problems, just with gas leaks that can kill, and most people not even having the proper air pollution monitoring in their homes. So, right. So gas carries its own risks, even in a disaster. And I think the answer when we are dealing with blackouts and other challenges, it's not to hold on to a technology or a fuel that is causing so much other harm, but to find the best solution for building better resiliency in the grid.
Well, thank you for the email, Joyce. We'll talk about health effects, but we have a number of callers on the line. So let's take those calls first. Let's go to Karen in Oakland. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. The person who sent the email with the question about blackouts is very similar to what I wanted to say, because here in California with the fire season and the roving blackouts that we have that are put on by PG&E to avoid fires puts us all in a situation where we can't even get a cup of coffee anywhere. So we have a gas stove, which I love. My husband wants to get an induction stove, and we're having this discussion about this. And so far, I'm still waiting to keep the gas stove until it no longer works. But in the last blackout, we were able to turn on only the burners with a match. We couldn't use the oven. But it was such a godsend because we couldn't use the microwave, and we were able to eat. Now, able to eat things from the freezer, from the refrigerator, et cetera. Without the gas stove, we would not have been able to do it. So in that way, I like my gas stove. I understand all the reasons why it's a problem, but I'm still a Luddite for my gas stove. That's all I want to say.
All right. Thank you for that comment. Any thoughts on that, Rebecca?
Yeah, this is your comment is so in line with a lot of the feedback I've heard after my story came out. So I certainly understand it. And I think the a few of the things to remember that I said at the beginning is people aren't going to lose their stove in their homes. That's not what the debate is over. We're talking about the building sector for decades to come. Because once we have gas hookups in those buildings, those gas hookups will stay in those buildings at a time that we need to be aggressively ramping down on our climate emissions. So we're talking about the next few decades of cleaner buildings. So that's just one thing I think that's important to remember, even while people are having these debates inside their own homes. And I think it's just the stove is a huge wedge issue here because it's something people are so familiar with. They use every day. They see it in their home. But things like gas lines and gas wells in something like a wildfire or another extreme weather event, those pose huge risks to the communities that surround them. There tends to be huge emissions events that are related. We're seeing that in Texas, that actually the amount of pollution coming from the gas industry has been undercounted and underreported. So just because it's not something that's inside someone's kitchen, I think it's something that we are more likely to overlook, but that these fossil fuels also carry a huge risk to one's personal health and to society.
Well, thank you for the call, Karen. Today we're speaking with Rebecca Lieber, a reporter with Mother Jones, about her latest piece, How the Fossil Fuel Industry Convinced Americans to Love Gas Stoves. And if you have any questions for Rebecca, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Rebecca reports that as more municipalities are moving to phase gas lines out of new buildings to cut down on methane emissions, gas utilities have gone on the defensive, launching anti-electric campaigns across the country. Let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Paul in San Francisco. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rebecca. I build fourplex houses, each with 100 solar panels, and I'm working in the town of Paradise now doing this. I've been one of the most important allies I have is Senator Wiener, and he's introduced a bill called Senate Bill 478, which will allow me to build fourplex homes with 100 solar panels in any town in California, no matter what the zoning law says. And most of the zoning laws are for single-family homes. And that's actually a footprint large enough to build a fourplex home on. So Senator Wiener introduced this bill, which is pure gold as far as I'm concerned, for switching California to solar. And for people that can't afford to right now just buy, there's a quick solution that you can do right now, in which a lot of people did during the wildfires. There's a company, I don't work for it, named Goal Zero, Z-E-R-O, that will sell you one solar panel and one battery. And that combination, even though it costs $1,500, will allow you to run your whole house from one solar panel. You know, you'll be able to run either your electric stove or your refrigerator one at a time. You can't run the whole house at once. But that one panel will allow you to keep your house running when there's a total shutdown of your gas, your electricity, whatever is shut down. And this is quite remarkable.
Bill, thank you for calling, because we've actually been wanting to do a show about solar panels. We've heard messages from listeners who say that there's a lot of bureaucracy and they're having a really hard time just getting it done. So we will definitely do a show about this in the near future. Thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Henry in San Francisco. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. By the way, I sit on the Code Advisor Committee, the San Francisco Department of Building Inspection. So all new housing, I think it's starting this year, will be required to be electric. I just want to remind the your person that's on, I forgot her name now.
It's Rebecca.
Stoves, sorry, Rebecca. Okay. Induction stoves, by the way, very popular in Australia. But you cannot use any pan on it. That's the only thing about it. But, you know, it is going to happen. That's what we're looking at. It is a better source of, you know, for, you know, your environment and all sort of stuff, and there's a push for it. And but I just want to point out that, no, with the induction stoves, you have to use particular sort of pans and pots in order to be able to use on the induction stoves. So, but, yeah, it's happening, and no matter what people might say, They are giving a break, though, for restaurants, because that's the ones that are going to have a tough time about it. Mm-hmm. You know, when you were using a wok and things like that, how are you going to do that with an induction stove? So just a comment from my end of it over here. And as I said, I do sit on the Code Advisor Committee. I'm sort of pretty familiar for the latest things that are going on with codes.
Well, thank you so much for that information, Henry. What are your thoughts on this, Rebecca? We have a few emails, actually, about the kinds of pots that you can use on these stoves. Can you talk more about that?
Right. Sorry if I misstated that. The reason I'm not personally an expert on the induction stove, I think, ties into some of the problems with our gas stove debate, in that I rent. And in DC especially, it's pretty common to find gas stoves, especially in rentals. So I don't have a choice between a gas stove and another kind. And I would love to have to try an induction stove. And I think this gets to some of the equity problems here that we didn't really get into. But the people this affects the most are low income people generally, because they're the ones who are in more, who tend to be in more cramped apartments where ventilation is not really possible. And that's when, where we're seeing the biggest risk for exposure to pollution, because you can't properly ventilate the space. And I know that's a bit of an aside from the induction question, but just to explain there, I think it's an important point.
This is a very important point. And in the section about health effects in your piece, you write that children are especially at risk. This is according to a study by UCLA. It was commissioned by the Sierra Club. Research shows that kids and homes with gas stoves are 42% more likely to have asthma than kids and homes with electric stoves. You report that running a stove and an oven for just 45 minutes can produce pollution levels that would be illegal outdoors. And then just one more stat here. One 2014 simulation by the Berkeley National Lab found that cooking with gas greatly increases carbon monoxide pollution by adding up to 3,000 parts per billion of carbon monoxide into the air after hour. Can you just tell us what else you learned about the health effects of gas stoves?
Yeah, some of the things I found actually most surprising in my reporting is that scientists have known this for decades, that since at least the 1990s, they've linked nitrogen dioxide, which is actually one of the most concerning pollutants from the stove, that it causes a range of health effects, especially in children and the most vulnerable with diseases like asthma. One thing that was surprising was how this mismatch between what the public understands and what scientists understand, especially the concerning pollutant nitrogen dioxide, which is not regulated indoors. It's also not picked up by people's carbon monoxide detectors. So we are really in the dark when it comes to the amount of nitrogen dioxide that's coming from the stove. And I think the other thing here, we're so used to the gas stove, but we are literally combusting a fossil fuel in front of our faces when we cook. And I think this is a debate that we're just at the beginning of, but this could be something we look back years, decades from now, just like we look at the effects of smoking on health indoors. That this is something that people don't quite have a grasp on the full range of effects. And that might change in the coming years. But I think we're just at the start of this debate and seeing and the public really learning that full range of effects on their respiratory and cardiovascular health.
Well, we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Lynn in San Francisco. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I live in San Francisco, and I feel like I live on a bomb that's going to get set off by an earthquake. So I am very aware of the natural gas lines below me. And I'm also aware that the grid is just no longer reliable. And I think we need to figure out how to power our cooking through a locally produced power source. And yet batteries are not recyclable yet. So that's not a viable answer. So I'm curious, what is the solution?
Thanks. Rebecca, what are your thoughts?
Right. That ties back to the issue of improving the reliability of our grid. And there are a lot of different ways we can do this. I think storage, energy storage, like battery technology is huge. Improving transmission so people can draw from cleaner sources that might be far away are really important areas. And that's where cities and states should not be on their own. That's where the Biden administration and its investment in energy research and technology that help us in this climate transition and address this reliability issue. That's where we really need more research investment, and we need deployment of that technology. So that's where the federal government really needs to come in, because we're not going to get those changes to the system without wider support. Cities can't do this on their own.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for the call. We will definitely do an infrastructure show or series of shows soon. So many issues have come out of what happened in Texas, and we just need to talk more about the infrastructure overall and what needs to change there. Rebecca, as always, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks. I'm so glad you're interested in covering this. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca Lieber is a reporter with Mother Jones, and you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org, How the Fossil Fuel Industry Convinced Americans to Love Gas Stoves, and another piece, These Ladies Love Natural Gas, Too Bad They're Not Real, An Oil Industry Group Went to Bizarre Lengths to Court Women. Coming up after a short break, we will talk about the historic nomination of Congresswoman Deb Haaland to head the Interior Department. If she's confirmed, she will be the first Native American to head a cabinet agency. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the historic nomination of Congresswoman Deb Haaland to head the Interior Department. If confirmed, she will be the first Native to head a cabinet agency. Her supporters say she will be a strong voice in the fight against the climate crisis. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee is expected to vote on her nomination this week before the full Senate chimes in. And here is Congresswoman Haaland speaking at her confirmation hearing.
Guatsi Hopa Duhiname Itzatuitsa Shuimi Hanu. Chairman Manchin, Ranking Member Barrasso, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. I wouldn't be here without the love and support of my child Soma, my partner Skip, who is with me this morning, sitting behind me, my mom, Mary Toya, who's watching from Isleta Pueblo, my extended family, and generations of ancestors who have sacrificed so much so I could be here today. I acknowledge that we are on the ancestral homelands of the Nacotchtank, Anacostan, and Piscataway people. As many of you know, my story is unique. Although today I serve as a member of Congress and was the vice chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, if confirmed, I would be the first Native American to serve as cabinet secretary. This historic nature of my confirmation is not lost on me, but I will say it's not about me. Rather, I hope this nomination would be an inspiration for Americans moving forward together as one nation and creating opportunities for all of us. As the daughter of a Pueblo woman, I was taught to value hard work. My mother is a Navy veteran, was a civil servant at the Bureau of Indian Education for 25 years, and she raised four kids as a military wife. My dad, the grandson of immigrants, was a 30-year career Marine who served in Vietnam. He received the Silver Star and is buried at Arlington National Cemetery. I spent summers in Mesita, our small village on Laguna Pueblo, the location of my grandparents' traditional home. It was there that I learned about my culture from my grandmother by watching her cook and by participating in traditional feast days and ceremonies. It was in the cornfields with my grandfather where I learned the importance of water and protecting our resources, where I gained a deep respect for the earth.
That is Congresswoman Haaland speaking at her confirmation hearing to head the Interior Department. This is a massive, massive agency. According to PRI, it manages more than 400 sites and 85 million acres in the national park system, includes the Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees endangered species protections and administers roughly 150 million acres in the National Wildlife Refuge System. The Secretary of the Interior also has final say over the quarter of a billion acres of public lands handled by the Bureau of Land Management. Joining us to talk about this historic nomination is Alia Chavez, a reporter with Indian Country Today, a digital news platform that covers news happening in indigenous communities around the country. Alia is a member of the Kia Pueblo, one of the 21 indigenous nations in New Mexico. Hi, Alia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me. And before we go further, it's pronounced Alia.
Alia, thank you. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for correcting me, Alia. You know, Alia, before, I've noticed that the majority of media outlets are focusing on what Republicans asked Deb Haaland. But what I want to ask you is, what this actually means to Indian country, because Deb Haaland went to Standing Rock. She stood with water protectors. As we know, if she's confirmed, she will be the first native to actually head a cabinet agency. So what does this actually mean to Indian country?
That's a great question. In my reporting, I've spoken to a number of sources who actually talk about this. And the word that I hear most frequently is the fact that this is monumental. And I think that's for a few different reasons. As you mentioned, one of those being that there is a lack of Indigenous representation in United States politics. And, you know, if she's confirmed, Representative Haaland would be the first Native person to lead a cabinet agency ever. And I kind of want to put that into perspective a little bit. So I've done some research in terms of the reporting that I've worked on, and I found that the first interior secretary in this country was selected in 1849, and that was 172 years ago. And since then, there have been very few women, let alone Indigenous people or Indigenous women, to serve as the Secretary of the Interior. And as you mentioned, this is a sprawling government agency that employs 70,000 people. It oversees the nation's public lands and coastal waters. And so, to say the least, monumental, I think, is the only way to describe sort of this process. And of course, if Representative Haaland is confirmed, I'm sure a lot of people will describe it as monumental, historic, just everything along those lines in terms of history making.
Right. And I've noticed on social media that a number of Native women have held Zoom calls over the last couple of weeks to really talk about how historic this would be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that goes without saying in terms of how Representative Haaland's support base has really organized. Indian country in general has really rallied behind her. And some of the organizers, many of who are Indigenous women, have created a what they call Deb for Interior Week. And so that happened twice so far, where, you know, these organizers have created social media kits so that people can download graphics, and created hashtags and drafted letters for tribal leaders to sign on to. And they've even projected photos of Representative Haaland on the side of the Interior Department in Washington, D.C. And so we're really seeing organizers come together, various Native and Indigenous organizations, you know, collaborating to make sure that Representative Haaland is confirmed.
What about tribal nations? We've done some parts of our shows have focused on the land back movement, and we're planning to do an entire show about that. Can you talk about what this could mean for tribal sovereignty, given that Congresswoman Haaland is Native, you know, and so many people really don't understand tribal sovereignty?
This is a very important point, and I'm glad that you raised it. I think that, you know, having Representative Haaland at the Interior Department, if she is confirmed, is obviously going to come with many hurdles. And when you're talking about land back, it's important for people to realize and recognize that just because she's there doesn't automatically assume that, you know, huge change could happen. But I think at the bare minimum, having Representative Haaland in the building and leading the Interior agency will really boost the amount of tribal consultation that happens. And for folks who may not be aware, tribal consultation is mandated by the federal government for federal agencies to consult and have conversations with tribal nations, with the heads of, you know, various tribes across the country, and sit down and say, you know, we're thinking about doing X, Y, and Z. How does this affect your tribal nation? Mm-hmm. And so at the very least, I think having Representative Haaland in the building will increase the amount of times that conversation happens, because unfortunately it doesn't happen. And a great example of that was in the former administration, administration, the Trump administration, when he was building his border wall along the southern border, some Arizona tribes were absolutely heartbroken to hear that some of their sacred sites were demolished in an effort to build that border wall. And they felt like they weren't consulted, and they should have been. And so I think that's something that we'll be able to see if Representative Holland is confirmed. We'll be able to see tribal leaders have a voice and a say in how their relations are being managed.
What can you tell us about where Congresswoman Holland stands on the crucial issues of the day when it comes to taking on the climate crisis? I mean, we know, if we're honest about these hearings, that a lot of it is political theater. I mean, some of the language that the Republicans used, I mean, I don't even want to play the clips. It's like they used this such a, you know, insulting language to score points, so it'll be played over and over again. And we know that Congresswoman Holland is also, you know, only able, she's working within this system. She's working for the Biden administration. So can you talk about the conversations you're hearing in Indian country about where she stands on crucial issues like leave it in the ground and what she will actually be able to do as head of the Interior Department?
I think that's a very good point, especially because in Representative Holland's confirmation hearing, we heard a lot of times her say that I have my personal views and I am here to push forward the Biden agenda. Right. And so, I mean, that's going to be a very interesting question in terms of how that actually comes to fruition. I think, you know, her personal agenda, as we've seen, is that she's vocalized opposition to fracking, to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, to the Keystone XL pipeline. But the Biden administration, as we all know, she would be tasked with moving that agenda forward. And so I imagine whatever President Biden wants or whatever his administration sort of collectively decides is sort of what we'll see her move forward on.
We're speaking with Aaliyah Chavez, a reporter with Indian Country Today, about the historic nomination of Congresswoman Deb Holland to head the Interior Department. Aaliyah, we talked about how this is getting covered in the U.S. media, just in terms of kind of leading with how Republicans questioned her. What has reaction been like in native media? How are they covering this?
That's a really great point. I think a lot of people have been really trying to describe the historic nature of Representative Holland's confirmation hearing. And, you know, up until if she is confirmed, of course, that's at least the angle that I've seen, really a lot of native media pushing on the fact that this is historic, that it's never happened before, that she's an indigenous woman, and really just focusing on the fact that history can be made here. The other thing that I've been seeing a lot of is, as you mentioned, it's kind of a long story, but the areas in which Representative Holland's confirmation hearing showed some tidbits of bias in terms of how the Republicans were asking her questions, how they were characterizing her. And so that's been another storyline that I've seen a lot of people and Native media focus on is the bias that she received.
Have you heard any tidbits of information about how people who work at the Interior Department will work with Congresswoman Deb Holland? Because in simplistic terms, a lot of people say it's really a good old boys club at the Interior Department. There's a lot of, you know, conservatives working there. A lot of people are very hesitant to embrace the change that a number of environmental justice activists are demanding right now. I mean, this is a massive agency. Can you give us any insights into that?
Yes, definitely. So far, since this new administration has began, we've been getting, journalists at least, have been getting press releases about the new hires in the Interior Agency. And what looks good for Indian Country is the fact that there's actually a number of Native people being hired in high positions in the Interior agencies, a number of those being people who work in the solicitor's office, which essentially are the lawyers for for the Interior Department. There's two Native people there. And of course, there will be a number of other nominations, appointments, and selections for other job responsibilities. But so far, we've reported stories on various Native people who actually have gotten jobs there, which of course, you know, doesn't happen very often. And so we've not only reported on Representative Holland's selection, but also on the selection of other Indigenous professionals in various high-level positions.
Very interesting. We have an email before we run out of time here. Alicia writes, who are the key players? Whom should we be contacting to support this crucial nomination? And we should say that last week, Senator Joe Manchin announced that he will vote to confirm Deb Holland as Interior Secretary.
Yes, that is true. And so far, the next steps are that the Senate Energy Committee will host a business meeting. And essentially at this business meeting, they'll decide how to process her nomination. And since Senator Manchin has said he'll vote favorably for her, we can imagine that it'll go to the full United States Senate. So if you wanted to support her and you felt very strongly, I would say that contacting your state senators is probably the best way to vocalize support for her.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Alicia, and we will definitely follow this and bring you the latest. Final question, Aaliyah. We have about a minute left. What are you hearing from Native communities about how they're planning to hold Deb Holland accountable if she is confirmed?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I think a lot of the rhetoric so far has really been around mobilizing and making sure she's put into office. But that'll be a very exciting story to follow as the months and years go on.
Aaliyah Chavez is a reporter with Indian Country Today, a digital news platform that covers news happening in Indigenous communities around the country. Aaliyah is a member of the Kia Pueblo, one of the 21 Indigenous nations in New Mexico. Aaliyah, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. We have an email from Sandy who says that one of the exchanges coupled with descriptions of Deb Holland as radical by white male Republicans left some feeling that Deb Holland was being treated differently because she is a Native woman. And Sandy sent over a quote from Cheryl Andrews Maltes, chairwoman of the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead, Aniqua in Massachusetts, who said, if it was any other person, they would not be subjected to being held accountable for their ethnicity. Well, thank you so much for that email, Sandy. And you could read more about Deb Holland's historic confirmation to head the Interior Department, the confirmation hearing, at yourcallradio.org. We'll continue to follow this. And if she's confirmed, which a lot of people say that this definitely is going to happen, we will do an entire show about Congresswoman Deb Holland to find out more about her plans at the Interior Department. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.